What we're going to discuss right now, I don't think it's not really meant to be inspiring. I wouldn't call it mussar, I wouldn't call it inspirational, but I think we're analyzing the challenge of Emunah, one of the things that go into it that's not so focused on, not as realized. And when somebody is looking to build their Emunah, it's definitely important to understand what are different challenges to it, or what are the reasons why some people have difficulty, and what are the methods in helping to strengthen it. So last week we spoke a lot about what great effect midos and personality have on a person's Emunah, both on how they picture Kadosh Baruch Hu and whether their mind is open and able to accept the concept of God creating the world and giving them everything they have or not. Today, though, we're going to discuss another aspect that has an effect on it. We're going to open up with a bunch of different questions that each question on its own is worthwhile to sit on and think about it, and even just to realize. It once happened, maybe not exactly like this, it might not have been the Coca-Cola company, but with some food company, that they came out with a message to the public of the world that something happened in one of the factories, and they know that there is a bottle of Coke out there that has poison in it, and whoever drinks it will die. But we don't know which bottle that it is. We know which dates it's between, which bottles after the following day. There's nothing to worry about before this date, you know, doesn't have to worry about. But it's only one bottle. And when you buy a bottle in the store, it's a one in a billion chance that you'll be buying that bottle. What do you think is going to happen to the sales of Coca-Cola bottles?
Go up.
No one's going to want to buy. That means everybody is concerned. And if they do buy, then when they drink it, they're like a little bit worried. They're thinking to themselves, wait, did I get that bottle? Am I about to die? Even if they push themselves to buy it anyway, they're thinking about it consciously. They're a little bit nervous. So people are concerned and take precautions even for a 1 in a billion or 1 in a 100 million chance. And we find that when people take out insurance, let's say on their house or on traveling or in different things that they buy, people are willing to put down money regularly for things with a relatively low probability. Like if there's a tornado, if there's an earthquake, if there's a this, then I'm going to get this amount of money, that amount of money. Where they don't actually think it's necessarily going to happen, but they'd rather be protected and not take that one in a whatever risk. People don't want to take those kind of risks. When there's a siren in Israel, and you know that there's a missile coming somewhere to Yerushalayim, whatever it is, people are running and they're pretty nervous. They're waking up their kids. Old people are getting very concerned. And they're running to shelters when everyone knows that the chances that the missile is going to hit specifically where you are very slim. It's a very small, one in a few hundred thousand, one in a, that specifically your spot in Yerushalayim is going to be the one that's hit. And yet people are very concerned. So why is it that when it comes to belief in God and the belief that what you do matters and that there's going to be reward and punishment and you will be judged one day, something that for 3,000 or so years, a large percentage of the world has believed in it, 50% or more, if you look at all the different religions of the world that have believed in it over all these years, we're talking about millions and millions, hundreds and billions of people over the years have believed in it, and yet we don't feel that concern. We don't take those precautions. We're not worried in that kind of way. And the question isn't going on the non-believers only. The question is going on even the believers, even myself. When I do keep Torah and mitzvos, when I stay away from sin, and when I do mitzvos, am I doing it with the same fear or concern as when I don't want to buy that bottle of Coke, or when I hear a siren of a missile coming in? And yet the chances of this are so much greater, and so many more people have... And these are things that we would give up our life for. In other words, if somebody would hold a gun to our head and say, do one of the big three sins or we're going to kill you. So most of us, I think, would give up our life over it. And yet we don't live with a fear or concern. When we went into Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, that would be considered a high level to actually feel the fear of the Yom HaDin on that day. That's something to work for. Why? With so many other things, we're worried and concerned so naturally and so easily. So why, when it comes to belief in God, is it not that way? The question gets even more confusing. When Torah Tragah goes every year on the Chet Te'elat, at some point, Super Bowl weekend, like right after the Super Bowl night and the day afterwards. And one of the things that we often do there, there's at night at 1 a.m. in the morning, there's a haunted house. It opens up late at night. And Torah Chaga doesn't pay for it, but they let guys go to this haunted house. And you go in, basically, as you approach the haunted house, it only opens at a very late hour. It's very creepy. There's screams, shrieks, babies crying. There's like blood-looking things coming down the windows, hands at the bars, you know, and like scary music in the background, and a deep voice saying, "Darkness." and like a little girl saying, "No, no, no." And everyone's like, "Okay, I'm doing it. Oh no, oh no, oh no." And sometimes the rebbeim go if the guys pay for it, and pay for them. And you go there, and but Ifra's done it, I've done it, Viva did it a few times. Refuges is a completely different experience. We'll have to analyze that a little bit later, and I'll say why. And you go, and you slip into groups of like five or six people. One of their band will go also, let's say. And everybody is terrified as you walk. Like, you don't know what you're about to face. Everybody's terrified. They're grabbing onto each other. "No, you be in the front. No, you be in the front. No, no, I'm not going to be in the front. I want to be in the middle. I want to be..." And their BAME too are a little bit getting pretty nervous. And everybody loses themselves. You'll have guys that are shrieking out curse words in front of the Rebbe. They lose all sense of self, you know, kavod. The Rebbe and themselves are grabbing on, screaming. Like, everybody is scared. And if you would ask any one of them, what are the chances that you are going to get hurt? Everyone would say 100% not. I know 100% nothing's going to happen to me, otherwise I would not be paying money to. I would not take a risk on my life. You don't actually think you're risking anything, and yet you are terrified. And your mind knows nothing's going to happen. How does that make sense? And then things that we know in our mind are real, or have a strong percentage chance that we're ready to sign up for it and give up our lives for it, we don't feel anywhere close to that kind of fear, if fear at all. How does that make sense? You sit and you watch a movie and you're at the edge of your seat, and there's somebody, I remember one of the last movies that I saw before I stopped watching was called Cliffhanger. Probably never heard of it, I don't know. But actually this was when I really stopped watching movies a year earlier, and under peer pressure I gave in and I went one more time a year later, and it was The Cliffhanger. And basically I remember like some lady was like falling off the cliff, and like she's holding on like this, and you see the fear in her eyes, and I was like so worried for her life. And I knew that in reality nothing happened to her. This is just an actress and everything is okay. And I was very nervous. I was very worried. And she did die. She fell off. No, not in real life. In the movie she died. And it was sad. You know, and if you're watching the movie, a little kid running into the street and a car coming, you're like, "Oh no, oh no, oh no." And you know everything's okay. This is just a movie. They have you exactly where they want you right now. And yet things that are real, we don't have that kind of concern, worry, nervous. What's going on over here? How do we make any sense? And if you think that this is just a religious, you know, issue, it's even more than that. Because forget putting belief in God aside. People have this struggle with things that they know and not living based on that, even when it comes to other things. Let's say somebody who's a smoker and they're told by cigarettes, And they're told by the doctor that you're going to die if you continue to smoke. Your lungs are horrible. This can't continue much longer. You are going to die. And yet, they still will struggle knowing that what they're doing is very damaging. They still will go ahead. And they won't be smoking nervous. While they're smoking, they don't feel nervous that moment when the doctor tells it to them. Or somebody who's going to Weight Watchers and they want to lose weight. And their mind knows, "I have to lose weight. The doctor said I'm very unhealthy, my cholesterol is too high." And still it'll be hard for them. What do you mean? But your life is at stake. You know in your head that this doesn't make any sense. And yet it's hard for you to perceive that when you see the burger, when you see the pizza, or the ice cream that's in front of you. It's hard for you to see things that this actually could kill me. And you don't see it that way. People are very responsible. We are willing to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars towards our education from kindergarten through master's, doctorate, because we want to make sure that we're going to have a good parnasa and be able to buy the home that we want and pay for the life that we want and be able to afford it for a certain number of decades. And we're very responsible and we're concerned about it. If you don't have a plan and you're already getting to, you're starting college a year into college, you don't have a plan, people are pretty down your throat. You're being irresponsible. That's not okay. And a lot is invested, time, hours, years, and money into our having a good, responsible plan for a solid 30, 40 years that we'll be able to work for. And yet, the people that believe strongly that there's an afterlife where it's for all of eternity, do they pump in as much money and are they as concerned and do they sacrifice as much towards responsibly preparing for their eternity afterwards? They believe in it just as strongly and they would give up their life over that belief. But do we, when we do mitzvos and we do go to davening and we do things that we give to davening, we do things that we know we're investing in our olam haba, but do we do that with the same feeling of I need to be responsible, with the same worry and concern if we're not doing it? Why does it happen? And again, I'm pointing a finger at the phenomenon and not at any organization. And we're all have the same struggle. But why is it that we're all pretty well educated in secular fields? We're good in math and biology and science and history. And yet many of us will still struggle reading a pasuk in Chumash or Rashi. Many of us may never have seen the first halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, would have difficulty reading it. We wouldn't necessarily know what the Sfarim and the Tanakh are, but we believe in these things, and we went to schools that taught us for 12 or so years. How did it come out that we're so weak in our Torah education, which we believe in? We believe in, and the schools that teach us believe in, and our parents that are willing to spend so much money, they're sacrificing money that could have gone towards making their lives more comfortable, towards saving for themselves, they're putting towards their children's education, and yet still, we come out really weak compared to our ability in secular studies. How did that happen? How does it happen? If we believe in those things, and we know them to be true in our mind. I left out a point that I want to make. It still fits into the same idea, and then we'll start to try to explain and answer it a little bit. You must have heard of Pascal's theory. I'm sure some of you heard of Pascal's theorem. He says the following. He says, there's four options of what could be true and how a person could live. Oh, it's very high in here. I think we should open, turn on the air conditioner. Yeah, that, Pascal's theory says the following. Pascal's theory says the following, that either there is a God and you live according to belief in God and then things worked out very well for you, or there is no God and you live as if there's a God and okay, at the end of the day you die anyway, and how bad was your life? If you look at believers' life, if they're fine, they're usually not suffering, they're pretty happy, so that wasn't a bad option. Or there's no God and you live as if there's no God and okay, we're fine. But one out of the four options is that there's a God and you live like there's no God and now you're in big trouble eternally. So usually when you have a 1 in 4 chance of something, so a person would not take such a massive risk with such a huge loss at stake. And why are so many people willing to take that risk? When you hear the alarm in the morning, or I don't know, not everybody here sets an alarm, I don't know why, when you hear the madrich come in to the room and knock on the door, so immediately you have in your head, so an argument. I have to wake up, but I want to sleep. I have to wake up, but I want to sleep. That is so weird. You're one person. What do you want? Why? Who's arguing over here? Who are the two sides? An animal, when he wants to be up, he's up. When he wants to sleep, he sleeps. There is no internal struggle going on within the animal. He does what he wants right now. What is going on? We have two personalities within us. Who are the two sides of this argument in our head right when we wake up? Or when a person who's not supposed to smoke the cigarette is thinking, I shouldn't do this. One more, what's it going to do? I've been smoking the last 20 years. This is not going to be the one that makes a difference, but you really shouldn't do that. There's two voices over there. Who are the two voices? Kadosh Baruch Hu made us with a body with a mind. Our mind is telling us one thing, and our body sometimes tells us something else. When you see an optical illusion, sometimes you could look at something and somebody says, do you see over there two faces looking at each other? No, I see an hourglass. No, come on, look carefully. Do you see two faces looking at each other? Oh yeah, I see it. No, I don't see it. I see it. So what is that? You're able, something could be there, you could know that it's there, but it can still be hard for you to sense it and to perceive it. There's two parts of that are within a person giving him two different messages. Your mind is telling you something and your body is telling you something else. Which one do we more identify with? When we say the word I, which one are we referring to? So when you wake up in the morning, do you say, I want to wake up, but my body is trying to keep me sleeping? No, you don't say that. You say, I want to sleep, but I have to wake up. In other words, who's the one that's getting in the way? Your mind is getting in the way. Your body is the one that very much relates to how you feel right now. You are coming more from the perspective of your body, than our mind. You don't say, I don't want to eat this pizza, but my hormones are pulling me into it. I want pizza, but I shouldn't. I mean, you shouldn't. You're going to, the doctor said, you're going to die if you eat these foods. Why don't you relate to what the doctor's saying? Why don't you identify with that much more? Why is it that I want to live and I'm not interested in this pizza, but my body... But no. No matter what, we always identify so much more with our body, with our mind. So it's a Lepedeberger. He says that Hashem created the world that way in order, because otherwise we wouldn't have free will. We wouldn't have Bechira Chavshas. It would just be too easy and too obvious. Yeah, God made the world. It's obvious. It's pleasure. I can do what he wants. And you wouldn't really feel two sides about it when you realize what the ramifications are and what in both directions. So in order for a person to feel that Bechira Chavshas, to have that free will, he made it in a way that you have those two voices with the body being stronger. But the Ramchal explains it further and explains how he did that. Most animals are born pretty fully developed in their mind. In a very short time, they're able to do what an adult animal is already able to do. But a human being is created as an infant, a baby, incapable, and their mind can't do very much. And if you've learned probably cognitive psychology or developmental psychology, and you learn about the different stages of brain development as you hit each different new levels of perception, slowly you grow until you're, 13, 14, 15, where now your mind is already able to have abstract thought. Your mind theoretically could be capable of overcoming the body. When you have a little kid, throwing a tantrum because he wants that bag of candy, logic is not going to change his opinion. And one of the ways they measure it is when you put in front of a kid, do you want one jelly bean now or 10 jelly beans in 10 minutes? I want one jelly bean now. If they're at a very early stage in the development. Why? Because the future, even 10 minutes from now, is not in front of them. And what speaks to them much more intensely is what's directly in front of them now. One of the ways that we measure maturity of the mind and cognitive ability is the ability to delay gratification and not need instant gratification. Because being able to delay gratification is you're able to see the future and act based on that as opposed to what's immediately pulling you right now. So Chazal said, Ezu Chacham Haroas Anola. Who's a Chacham? One who could see what's going to be born out in the future. If you're able to look ahead 80 years from now, 90 years from now, and think in terms of how they're going to bury me one day, and there's going to be a spadim, and I'm going to have a grave. Something's going to be written on that grave, and something's going to be said on my spadim. What do I want to leave behind? What's important to me? Looking back at the kids I'm going to leave behind, the grandchildren I'm going to leave behind, what is the main thing that's important to me? And then live like that now, when I'm 16, 17, 18, 19, making the choices that are going to actually set my life towards that 90, 100-year-old man, looking back, a lot of his life went based on those decisions during that age. That's a very powerful ability when somebody's able to do that, to remove themselves from the pulls of the instant here and now, right now, or this week, or next month, and instead think. That's a chacham. That's somebody who's really able to empower their mind over their body. But that's a lot of the struggle of emunah. Sometimes people feel like, they have weak emunah, I don't feel like Kadosh Baruch Hu, I don't see a Kadosh Baruch Hu. This is no different than the struggle that you have with waking up. is no different than the sugar you have with stopping to smoke or with stopping to eat when you, if you're an overeater. And any other struggle that's the mind over the body, where the mind can know something as a fact, I am not going to get hurt in this haunted house, there's zero chance. This movie is fake. And yet your body is sensing I'm in danger. And I'm sensing something very scary. And things are popping out of me and there's lights flashing and there's scary music in the background. And your body wins over. Ever go in an elevator with glass windows? The whole thing is glass. Some people freak out from that. That's very scary. Or imagine they would create maybe there is one, a glass hallway across the Grand Canyon where you have to walk across it and it's so clean and perfect that's probably, you're like, and now every day, somebody could work on the top floor of a skyscraper every day and not feel that fear that they would have when they go with their family on a trip and have to walk across that, and they're relying on the same trust of the floor that they're standing on. But now your senses are screaming, what are you doing? Why are you walking over this deep abyss? Even though his mind knows that it's not true. It's that same struggle, because since you can't see God, and you don't see his hand, you could know it, you could believe it, but you don't experience it with the senses of your body in an obvious and an immediate way. So therefore, that's a massive challenge within Emunah. But it's not necessarily going to help in that case to just read Permission to Believe and Permission to Receive another few times. Those are good books, and they're helpful, but they're very much a beginning stage and maybe not even something that everybody needs. Because a lot of the challenge is empowering your mind over your body. And there are things that, and therefore, part of working on Emunah is training ourselves to make the things that we know in our mind more experiential, to make it more that we live it. Like, for example, one of the things that they might do if you go to Weight Watchers is they might show you a movie. We'll show the ladies, usually ladies, right? That show them a movie where they show you really what a donut is and what happens to the donut while it goes through your body, and or like red meat. Like they'll show you like how they'll shuck the animal and how they open it up and pick out the parts. But so, for somebody that shouldn't have it, let's say. And in other words, they show you things to make it gross to yourself. And it was to speak to your body. To speak to your body. So when you want your mind knows something, but you want to live like that, so how do you convince your body to live like that? You have to give your body those experiences. So first of all, talking about it a lot. Making visualizations. That's the power of a mushal. Giving mushals, bringing things alive for yourself, makes it much more of an experience that you bring it much more to life. Where you make what you know in your head already to be something much more like as a real life experience. And that takes a lot of work and that takes effort. But our actions lead towards these things. For example, I want to give the example probably of, let's say somebody's working on cursing. Let's say they're cursing for many years. They don't feel so bad when they curse. But they want to work on it. They know logically in their mind that it's bad, but they don't feel so bad when they curse, but they want to stop. So if they stay away from it for an extended period of time, let's say 2 or 3 months go by where they don't say a curse, then all of a sudden when they do curse, they feel like something dirty just came out of their mind. They actually feel really bad. And that's the correct reaction. So they've trained their body and their senses to react more according to what they knew in their mind beforehand by training themselves. And when somebody's learning to fly a plane, from what I understand, one of the complications in flying a plane is sometimes your eyes and your body are telling you one thing, but the truth is differently. Like, I don't know how this could be, but they say, really you're flying the right way, but you feel like you're upside down. Something like that.
Yeah, it's very
right. You know, or you think you're going right, but really you're going left. So what do? You have to trust the dials, what the dials are telling you, and don't trust what your senses are telling you. So what do to the pilots when they need to train them that? So they sit in class and tell them over and over again, trust the dials, trust the dials, trust the dials. Is that going to help so much? What they really do is they give them simulations. They create some type of an arcade game where it feels very real and you're in the plane and you have to work on yourself over and over again, fighting what your body is telling you and following what your mind is telling you. It's training. They have to train themselves. Soldiers have to train themselves to be able to hear machine gunshots but keep on acting without any fear, because naturally they're going to feel fear, but they can't feel the fear. They have to act, they have to be responsible, they have to train themselves. emuna, empowering our mind over our body and visualizing the world that way, it requires training. It requires stimulations. It requires telling ourselves mashals, reading svarim about it, bringing it more part of our regular everyday experience. Now, in our generation, I think it got even more challenging because, and maybe I'll even read you some quotes, and you probably know more than me, but so many billions of dollars were pumped in to creating machines that would work on the human weaknesses. We have thousands of top psychologists working on figuring out what pulls in a person's attention and will keep him using my app for as long as possible and keep on going back to it. What is it that people like? What stimulates them? What speaks to them? What type of bleeps and bloops, noises, what type of effects, what type of responses they want to make them use my app more? And basically, how do we brainwash this person to stay stuck on my app and make it successful so we can make a lot of money? And every single, what makes a successful app is one that's made understanding your psychology and what would best, they're not looking to serve you, they're looking to serve themselves, and how could I get them to be addicted to my app? And when you read some of the things, you've heard this, here it says, Sean Parker, the founding president of Facebook, said in a conference last year in Philadelphia, the thought process that went into building these applications, Facebook being the first of them, was all about how do we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible. That means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while because someone liked or commented on a photo or post or whatever, and that's going to get you to contribute more content, that's going to get you more likes and comments. The inventors, creators, me, Mark Zuckerberg, Kevin Systrom on Instagram, all these people understood this consciously, and we did it anyway. When you read articles like this, and you let's say you were to now investigate this and see what goes, let's say you would take it more from like the university perspective. Let's say I want to be an app builder. I want to be an app creator. And you read what goes behind how they're trying to lure you in. That's a way you could start to just get disgusted by these things. And the article goes on and says that a lot of the founders of it wouldn't let their kids use it or touch it. They themselves don't use it, or very minimally. They put, they give themselves limitations because they understand the dangerous psychology that's behind it. And some of them even withdrew from the companies altogether because they started feeling pretty guilty when they realized the billions of people that their brains are being played with in a massive way. And they look, and now they're involved in more altruistic causes because they have a lot of guilt. It goes through a list of people and what jobs they switched to because of the guilt that they were living with. When you read these kind of things, that's one way of fighting. Your body is constantly, with every single app, being trained to have instant gratification and not empower mind over body. We're going backwards. The kid's brain is supposed to slowly move on where he's able to delay gratifications and make more responsible decisions based on future thoughts, your mind making much more, your objective thought having a lot more to do with it. And people now are willing to do things that they know have no logic behind it. They're not productive, they're not helping me, and they're not stopping because they're hooked and they're caught into it. And I need that instant gratification. So of course challenges in Amunah are going to be hard, and we don't have the patience to deal with them. Of course Gemara is going to be all that more of a pain in the neck because you actually have to think and wait to see the results of effort and not get them immediately. And that's what makes things even more challenging today. I always, when I heard that midrash of Avraham Avinu, where he went and he broke all the idols. He broke all the idols in the house, and then he put the axe in like some big idol's hand, and then when Terah came home, he said, what happened over here? Well, he was hungry and they took his food, so he killed all of them, and then Avraham was in trouble. I was thinking like, Avraham is saying such a pasha thing, and yet they all want to burn him to death. The whole world wants to kill him for saying something so logical, like, give this kid a break, like answer his question or or something like, he's saying something so logical and what you're doing is so illogical, and he made such a good point to you, and yet they don't want to hear him say it, they don't want to deal with it, they want to get rid of him. Sometimes you get masses of people that, because everyone is doing it, therefore it's okay, and therefore that's how we deal with the questions that I had. Wait, is this normal? It's normal because everybody's doing it. But with living like that, you become like a Nazi Germany, where Hitler was able to win over Germans, turn them into Nazis, do sick things, through showing them cartoons, through making laws that made the Jews look like something was wrong with them, or they were lower class. When you get masses of people to do one thing, you brainwash them, then every individual, it's hard for them to break out of that way of looking at things. And you could have a kid in yeshiva think that, I don't want to get brainwashed. Give me a break! Every single app on your phone is brainwashing you. Like, what are you talking about? So much psychology went in, way beyond, here they're just teaching Torah, here they're just teaching you what you would give up your life for, what your parents pumped so much money in for you to live that way for. No psychologist went behind to figure out methods to draw you in. And yet, we get caught up in what captured all of society to make, for the people on top to make money off us. And we know this, and we just go right into it. We're concerned about being brainwashed. We're so concerned about being brainwashed. Our brains are dysfunctional for the age that we're up to because of what we've been trapped in. And it's not our fault. We're victims of the society that we live in, but we have to protect ourselves. There is an app that a lot of guys in the past have used, and stuff like it helped them a lot, called Moment. I told it to somebody before, some of you got it. I bet guys already know what it is. Moment, basically, it's just between you and the phone. It's an app. It doesn't cost any money. It's free. And it tells you all the time, you could check it, how much screen time you've had that day. And last year, guys looked at it, and they couldn't believe it. They were freaking out. One guy had 12 and a half hours, another guy had 9.5 hours. He was shocked. He couldn't believe it. If you compare that to the amount of time that he actually listened in shiur, or actually worked on what was in front of him in the Gemara, which probably added up to less than an hour over a day, and he looked at like how many hours he pumped into the apps on his phone, and that knowledge itself helped. Watching himself how many hours, because it's making it more experiential. It's not just something theoretical in your mind, but you're seeing it right there in front of you. Another thing that helped some people, but most people broke out of it, they couldn't keep up with it, but in your phones, there's something called grayscale. You go to settings, you go to color or something, you go to grayscale, you don't have to download anything, you can make your phone black and white. It can still do everything, but your phone is black and white, and studies show that you use it a large percentage less a day when your phone is in black and white. It makes you use it much more for just practical things that you need it for, and not just to be on it. These are ways to help combat us doing illogical things, pouring out hours of our time into things that don't bring us anywhere, and make our brains more and more dysfunctional, less and less live with a purpose, even care to live with a purpose. Even care to live. It used to be that kids your age would naturally not, they would bother them. They would want to talk to Rebbeim all the time, like, why am I here in this world? What's the point? What's the purpose? What am I doing? I think it's much less. People, there's much less abstract thinking, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. You could attack me afterwards if I'm wrong. But we have to protect ourselves and our brains and our lives and our children's lives. Go ahead.